Dear brother Elvin, and greetings to each of you in the name of the Lord. It's been a long time since I've stood behind the pulpit. And so I need your prayers this evening. On top of that, our speaker this morning stole my subject, except he spoke on another part of it, and I'm going to speak on a different part of it this evening. And I agree with him that this spot out here is not going to save any of us. It's our faith in our Lord and Savior Jesus Christ that will save us. But there are things about that spot that some know and all should know. And especially our young people who don't get much introduction into that part that I'm going to bring you this evening. And neither do have some of our older people. And that is the subject that I want to bring this evening. There's no possible way that I can bring all that I would like to say, or that the Lord would like to have me say, on this subject that in the hours left in this day, much less in the 1 hour that's been allotted to me. I'm going to try my best to stay with that. I don't know exactly when Brother Norman was given the topic of his sermon, but Al and I had hardly hung up the phone, what's it been, about 6 weeks ago or so? And this subject was given to me, just like somebody had turned on the light. And in the turmoil of buying a home and getting into it, and getting ready to get into it, and all the details and miscellaneous that goes with it, I didn't have near enough time to prepare for it that I would like to have. But on the other hand, if it is of the Lord, I don't have to worry about that. All I have to worry about is presenting to you that which the Lord puts in my mind and in my mouth. And that is what I pray for. And that nothing else will enter. And what I want to bring to you is a history of this spot of land. We are not owners of it. I, and I hope none of you, worship it. But I, and I hope all of you, do reverence this place as the place and the spot that the temple will be built, to which the Lord will come in this last day. While Ether didn't, the brother Jared designate this spot, or any spot, where the New Jerusalem, well, I don't think he called it the New Jerusalem, but he called it, and I don't have that reference handy, but he referred to it as the, that in this land there would be builded up a city unto the Lord in these the last days, not in the day of his crucifixion and resurrection, but in the day of his second coming and bringing judgment. This is bringing in some other scriptures to it in kind of a summarial frame. But the Book of Mormon, in several chapters, or several books, including Nephi, speaks of a new Jerusalem that was to be built upon this land. And back in 1967, the church, under the auspices and cooperation of the General Church, presented a pageant when the old monument out here that referenced the corner of the temple was erected and dedicated. Many of you have seen the four plaques that were on all four sides of that marker. And I shouldn't say monument because it wasn't a monument, it was a marker. Much as the plates that are laid out here, the stones that are laid out here now, marking out the temple. And my mother, among others, and I believe Sister Marion Sprague, who, Brother Rollins' wife, my mother's youngest sister, and Nicholas's youngest sister, were part of a committee that got this pageant together and presented it. They started a wagon train of, I think it was maybe three, I know there were two, started down at the foot of River Boulevard, where it meets the river, which now is a part of Cement City property. And I think Brother Joe Yates drove one of them, and possibly one of his sons drove the other. Or it might have been Floyd Jr. That drove them. But anyway, they drove the team up and to here, and they had a circling of the wagons in commemoration of that time. I want to go back a great long way in the history to begin with. And while my mother was given the responsibility of narrating the pageant, there was input from all of that committee into it. So while I'm going to read from it in her or in the committee's words, I would not in any way put any slight to any of the members that were on that committee. I'm not sure that Sister Silver Breasty, or Sister Silver Rudd, rather, as she was known then, I've known her both names, was a part of that committee. And they all had many testimonies that they used to bear and I used to hear. And so I'm going to start here with some facts and information that my mother and father gleaned among the Indian people, and which Velma and I have also verified among many of the tribes that we work with out in the West and down in Oklahoma. And they all, as is said here, are pretty much the same. There might be minor details in some of them that are different. But I believe you'll gain much from this. Now, there's 10 pages of this, and I'm not going to read 10 pages. I'm going to cut parts of it because it's not pertinent to the question I'm addressing this evening. But I will start here. There are many legends among most all the tribes of American Indians, which have a somewhat similar ring to the ear of all people of the Christian faiths. And I would have to say that Christian would be more of the Restoration than of the Protestant churches, although that's not denoted here. And among them is a legend concerning this temple lot, which is had by Indians in widely separated areas. Many of them, presumably because of it, have looked upon the temple lot with such reverence that they remove their shoes to walk up on it. And many do that yet today. Not only the Indians, but I've seen others remove their shoes to come up on this ground and go out in the center of the temple site and kneel in prayer, or they'll have prayer circles, and Indians do this from time to time. And this is what is, I don't know that reverence is the correct terminology. Well, there's nothing wrong with the terminology as long as we understand that they're not worshiping the ground, but they are remembering the prophecies that they have received concerning this place and what's to happen here. That's the important thing. What's going to happen here on this spot of ground in the days ahead? That they may remove their shoes. There have been many marks of identification familiar to them in this general area of the temple lot. Temple lot's approximately to the old Indian spring. Now that's the old spring that's there on the corner of Nolan and Truman Road. It's now been stoned over, and I'm not sure it's not inside the little building that they've built on top of it. But that used to be, when I was a kid, an open spring. And even when I was young, we would take our cups or our hands or whatever, and we'd drink fresh, clean, cool water, very refreshing water. And it ran on down into the creek, Spring Branch. And that's where Spring Branch got its name. It started right there, out of the springs that are under, the rock ledges in this part of the city. And, so she's saying here, the temple lot's proximity to the old Indian spring, its distance from the Missouri River, and even the position of certain stars at certain times of the year, a sort of sky map, are some of their landmarks. Now, we tend to think that sky marks or sky maps, mapping the stars, are something of a new invention. Columbus knew a little about it, and those of his age, his time. But when you travel among the ruins of the Indian people of this land, you find many star maps on stone and rock. And while they're not all understood as to where what they designate, it is clear when you look at them, you can see the North Star, the Big Dipper, and all the other constellations. Not in all of them, but in each one of them, you can recognize yet today what part of the sky is mapping. Now, one of the things that she is referring here to was, and there had been two or three that had come of the Indian people. The first one was You don't talk loud enough for me to hear my memory back there. he was a Klan head down on the Navajo reservation when the folks were working down in that area back in the 40s and 50s. And he came here. In fact, Roland and his family knew him. It was through him that the two Indian children, a boy and a girl, were adopted by them and raised for a number of years. They both went back to the reservation, but the girl, the last time Velma and I were over in that part of the country, she still lived above Winslow, I believe it was, and we went to visit her. Well, we went to visit her several times while we were out there. She still remembered the church. She still remembered the Sprague family as well as our own family and many others here in the church at that time. And she felt very isolated and alone because she was the only member of the church out there in that whole area. But going back to individual I was speaking of, he was also one of the delegates to the tribal council that meets in Winter Rock, which is the capital of the whole Navajo nation. And he came here one fall, and he would go out during the day, and he would come back. And one day he left a little while before dusk, as I remember my mother relating it, and it's not in this. And he was awful late coming back. She began to wonder, and my dad too, if he'd fallen into some of quote-unquote Indian ways, but white people have the same problem, and sometimes even worse. Again, we're the one that took them the fire water and taught them how to drink it because it made money for us. So we don't have any reason to look down on the Indian because he uses alcohol. We use it as an escape. And there are probably more alcoholics in the United States and probably the world than there are non-alcoholics. But anyway, they began to wonder if he had gotten drunk and gone to sleep somewhere. And when he finally came in, it was close to midnight. He was all muddy, and my mother at first was pretty sure that she had been right, that he had found a bottle somewhere and had gotten drunk. But when she began to question him, and then Dad got and questioning him also, he said that he was looking for a marker, and my mother asked him what kind of a marker. Well, he says it's a little pile of stones somewhere up here, and he described this area between the stone church and the auditorium and Independence. And she said, well, what kind of stones were they? And he described them, that they were about fist size, something that they could carry in their hand. And he said, I found all but one marker, and that's that pile of stones. And so they related the history of the temple lot, that that pile of stones is the pile of stones that history records that Joseph poured oil on at the time he laid the marker stone that referenced to that northeast corner. And it was found in 39 when they, or 29 rather, when they began the excavation. And so she said, there used to be a pile of stones up here. She described where it was. Just, it was almost even to the back corner, back the west side of the old church and out, well, at that time about 30 feet from the church, because the old church sat way over here. And he said, well, that is the other marker that I'm looking for. And he said, what happened to you? Where are they? And she told him that when they began to mow the lawn out here, all this was way back, not too long after the saints returned here in 67, they began to use horse and horse-drawn mower to mow, and got it down to where eventually it, around the church, it was mown by a push mower. And I've pushed one of those mowers here when I got big enough. And they had taken those stones then because they were kind of hard to move there, and there were a lot of vines and stuff that would grow up in them that they had to clean out, and they just decided it was easier if they just moved them. And we used to have a coal shed that set, well, probably about where the choir loft is now. Wasn't too big, but that's the heat we had in the old building at first. Eventually, they put in gas. And they put those on one side, and then when they'd have to mow that, well, they'd have to move them on the other side. And I've moved those stones myself. When I was going to school, I started school back in what's the parking lot now, just south of the auditorium in the old Columbian School. And we used to play out here in used to call it Curtis Pasture, and for recesses at noon. And they finally had to board up the classroom windows when they started construction, because the construction was more interested in our school lessons. And we would still try to peek through the cracks when the teacher would leave the room, but we did get more studying done. And eventually, one of the caretakers, not knowing what the stones were about like some of us would not know today if we were to see them, had them hauled off down to the river in what used to be the old city dump down there. And when we came back from Idaho in 37, well, one of the first things that my mother noticed was that those stones weren't there anymore, and she wanted to find out what happened to them. And she learned what they were, and the caretaker was questioned. He was no longer the caretaker. He had retired. And they asked him if he knew where they were. And Uncle Elmer Frisbee, who was the first child born here in Missouri after the saints returned in 1867, was with the folks, and they needed somebody that could get down into the water and feel around, because they he had been bulldozed, and so that was my job. I went down and I was familiar with the one. And the only thing I could find was big boulders like this down in there, and trees and that sort of thing, and so it was finally given up. And he was concerned about having lost track of them. But he was satisfied that this was the place that he had found. He mentions star maps. Edward Cowboy is the name of the man that I was trying to think of, the Navajo. Howard Laharoo later explained in more detail to the folks what they looked for, the various Indians, when they came. And over on the Missouri River Bluff on this side, Cement City or the old oil refinery down there, up to where the bridge is now, he said there were several markers over there, marking different things. But he said that there was one right down in that part where River Boulevard goes down to the river, the old landing, that probably most of them used. And he said that they used similar to what surveyors like myself use for, and navigators for star fixes and so forth. They would make a tripod out of sticks, and then they would take a little string and they'd hang a rock on it, and then they would get down and they would sight at a certain hour of the night and a certain time of the year, and when that star moved in line with that string, then that was their east-west line, and the north-south line was from that marker down on the Missouri River. And he told him a number of other things about this location. He related this very same story that I'm using here this evening, that I haven't quite got to yet, but I'm going into it now. They had used the star maps, they had used the landmarks, and today surveyors do this constantly. Navigators use them constantly. When you use landmarks, we call it, help me out now. navigation by landmarks. Anyway, there's a name for it. And by stars, it's called celestial navigation. And so they located the spot. And then Howard told them this legend from his tribe, which the folks, and Velma and I don't know whether others have, I assume they have some, verified from various Indian peoples. The folks have heard it all up and down the East Coast, among the East Coast Indian tribes, the Narragansetts and up where Eli and Gretchen live, up in that area, as well as over where the Great Council of Indians, Iroquois Confederacy, are. White Cloud, who was a Minnesota Indian from the tribe of Minnesota, related this story to us, to them. And so it's pretty widely known. So I'll go on and read that part of this narrative. One version of the legend is that many, many years ago, when the tribes came to this area where the trade routes, that is the Indian trade routes, from every direction like the spokes of a great wheel, and which was stretched with stocked with much wild game, they would fight over the area. And Missouri used to be, before the white man came and cut it all down, we had a lot of pine as well as other deciduous trees in this line. That is, evergreens and deciduous both. And it was a very fertile hunting ground. It supplied winter meat for numerous tribes as far north as Minnesota and as far south as the Gulf and halfway to the east coast and out to the desert lands to the west. And so they would fight over the area. And then one day, when the fighting was very fierce, the Great Spirit, or God, Great White God, appeared to them and told them to cease fighting and to go to the river and wash the paint, the war paint, off of their faces in the and to fight each other no more, that they were brothers and must live in peace. They did as they did so, and the river ran red with blood from the water, from the war paint, I'm sorry, as there were so many of them. Now, when I was a boy, the Missouri River used to freeze over in the winter. You could walk from St. Louis on the ice all the way up into Minnesota, or not Minnesota, but up into the Dakotas. Never set foot on land, and never get your foot wet either, except by the snow and ice. And it wasn't until in the 40s and 50s that the river was stabilized to where it runs now, and also all those big reservoirs up in the Dakotas and Montana were built as flood control system, as well as irrigation and provide year-round water for the cities. And now we're finding that they're complaining about that because we're destroying birds and natural habitat and fish that can only live where the water comes and goes. So it's like all white men, they're never satisfied with what they have. They want something different, they want more. And not just white man, but that's man for you. That's the creature God created and put here for his purpose. To go on then, they did so, and the river run red with the war paint. What I was going to say was the river used to run clear. But when they cultivated so much land, and still do, it washes in, erodes in, and out in Kansas you can still see canyons 40 and 50 feet deep that have been eroded out of what used to be prairie grasslands. And that's what muddies the rivers in this area. Some people think that Missouri River meant Muddy River. It wasn't. It's named after the tribe of the Missouri Indians that lived along this stretch of the Missouri River. He told them that the ground whereon they stood was holy ground, and that in the latter times a great lodge, the term used by many Indians to denote a religious edifice like a temple, would be built on this spot to which he would come. He told them to return to their homelands and tell their people of this experience, and that each tribe was to send a runner with a small stone which they could carry in their hand or in a pouch, native to their homeland, and come and deposit it at the hub of this great wheel of trails that came into this area. As a symbol or pledge to each other and their creator, that they would live in peace with each other, and to mark the spot where the great house of the Lord would be built someday. Would stand someday. Yes. I see my time is kind of getting away with me, but I want to get down now to, we all know that Joseph and a number of the elders, he received a revelation to come to Missouri, and that he would be shown where that spot that we've been discussing was. And in August of 1831, on the third day of August, they came, the first settlement came, and they had settled over at what is now Paseo and about 63rd Street, just below those bluffs over there. And they came from there over here on that day, a few of the elders, I think there were five, maybe six, and they laid that corner, the reference to that corner. They anointed the pile of stones that was still there, and I believe it's E.D. Howe's history, which Maynard used to have a copy of. I think he had a copy, at least he had access to it, that said that they also had marked a sapling that was about 5 foot west of where he had planted the stone, which is downstairs. Now, as far as the stones, no, we should not worship them. But we should reverence them. We should care for them because they're a testimony of what the Lord has done, one more testimony, what the Lord has done concerning this place. And the land belonged to the state at the time that they dedicated it. They wanted to buy just a few acres right in here. I don't know exactly how many they wanted, but they were required to buy a whole tract of 63¾ acres, I believe it is, or 2/3, which took in all the way from this street over Lexington where it curves, and can't remember, Pacific, I think, from Pacific to Pleasant, and from the railroad to Lexington. That was the 63 acres. And when the saints were driven from here in 1835 to 38, before they were finally driven clear out of the state because of their iniquities, many of them went to Nauvoo, but there were a number that went back to the vicinity of Bloomington, Illinois, which had been their home before they had come here in 31. And they came to be known as the Crow Creek branch of the church. There were actually seven small locals banded together, a few at a time. They sent out invitations, and Granville Hedrick attended the various branches of the church after Joseph's death in 44. And none were willing to come and join with him. And this continued, and in 1852 or 53, the Crow Creek branch in conference wrote and adopted what's called a Declaration of Independence, similar to this country's declaration, in which they declared themselves separate from all other divisions, branches of the Restoration. And it was from that beginning then that several of the elders that came down with families, and some I assume that were not elders or priesthood, came. Get a little ahead of myself. In 1864, Granville Hedrick received a revelation that the saints should prepare to return to Missouri in 1867. Well, the Civil War had just ended a couple of years earlier, and feelings were very strong against Yankees. During the war, there had been a number, and my great-grandfather Denham's family were removed from Independence and sent out in Kansas because they were Southern sympathizers. They left with what was on their back and a few things they could push in a cart. And that's the way peace was established and maintained here in this borderland. Even though Missouri was supposed to be a slave-free state, it wasn't until sometime after the Civil War. In fact, I'm not sure that it is yet any of the states, for that matter. But be that as it may. From that point, they began, that is, the Crow Creek branch began to prepare to return to Missouri in 1867. They left in the winter of 66-67, and they came through, and I'm not going to rehearse all of the things that transpired when they arrived on the far bank of the Missouri River. But it was February, and it was an early thaw, unexpected. And George P. Frisbee had been a ferry operator on the Mississippi River with his father for a number of years, and he had faith in that prophecy, that it would be fulfilled if only they would keep faith. And he persuaded them to stay, and some wanted to turn back when they saw the condition of the ice. But he took across first and with his family, and it made about 2-inch tracks in the ice. And when he reached the other side, a great shout of joy and praise to the Lord went up. And he had instructed them before he left that if he got across safely, that they would come one wagon at a time. They all arrived on the south side of the Missouri River safely. Nothing was lost, not cattle, horses, stock of any kind. And if they hadn't, they would not have been able to get in a crop before the river cleared of ice to where they could ferry across the river, which would be sometime in July in those days. And so they were able to plant their crops and be able to weather the winter coming on. Now, that's the story of how they got here, briefly and roughly. Why we stay? And first of all, how many of you have a reason, have an answer to the question I've written up here? Show your hand if you want to. I sure have. Okay. There may be different reasons. Some have, well, I was born here and I just didn't feel like going anywhere else. Others of us have had many testimonies of staying right here, owning land, owning I say stewardship of our land, even my home, as far as I'm concerned. And so they came. They had rough times, but they had good times. And then in, I believe, well, first of all, before we get to that, when they came, this area, the whole, about half of the 63 acres, had been subdivided by different subdividers and builders into individual lots. They, one of the things they were told in Granville's Revelation in 64 was that they should come in 67 and buy up the temple lots. And that's what they did. They bought them up one at a time, put them under a trusteeship in the church, and some used to think that the old Kansas Street there, because the curb cut was there, and over here, that little triangle out there used to belong to it did belong to the city. But we, because we had given an easement through there for that road, which was never built. And I've got pictures that show that all under garden out there, almost right up to the side of the church, clear out to the corner. But anyway, they bought the temple lots. Just in passing, it's strange that they knew where the pile of stones were. They knew what the pile of stones were. Some think they didn't know what the dimension of the temple was. Well, it's a strange thing that the center line of the lots on the south and lots on the north, and there used to be an easement for an alleyway through there, but that's almost exactly the center line of the temple when you look on the surveys. And I have. Many times. And so they knew how big the temple was and just where it was to sit. Along in 1894-5, the organized church began a big project of getting all of the old church property into their name. They had been successful in Nauvoo, and they didn't think that they would have any trouble from this little handful of Hebrewites down here on the temple lot. And so they went into court, and I'm not sure whether the judge was RLDS or not, but he sure had a strong leaning for them, and he made judgment in their behalf. And they were overjoyed and happy, but before they could occupy, we appealed it to the appellate court in St. Louis. The appellate court overturned that ruling and restored the temple lot to the Church of Christ. The RLDS then filed a suit before the United States Supreme Court. In all of these things, it was very, very hard on our people. There probably weren't 50 members in the Church of Christ at that time. women would two trials, I think they were all right with they didn't have to sell anything except donations for the first trial, because it was here in Independence, and just didn't take so long. But when it went to St. Louis, the women had to hawk their rings, their wedding rings, jewelry, The men made other sacrifices. They worked extra hard at their fields and would get good crop, and that was paid for. During the preliminaries to the Supreme Court, our people were just flat busted. They didn't have anything. So they decided that they would send a committee of three to Salt Lake City and get a mortgage against the temp lot for $1 million to fight that suit. That's about what they thought it might be. I believe it was $1 million. Maybe it might not have been that much. But anyway, whatever they estimated the court cost to be. And about halfway out across Kansas on the train, a person came to them and told them that I don't know what kind of introduction it was, but he told them to turn around and return to Independence, and the Lord would provide the way to pay for that suit. Well, they did. And my great-grandfather, the one that was the first to cross the Missouri River, had a big apple orchard. And he promised the Lord that whole crop, whatever he got out of it, would go to the fighting of the lawsuit, financing the lawsuit. And all of the Virgil's mother remembers and used to tell about what she had heard from her parents about that. And all of the Denham family and the Frisbee families and all of those of the Cole families. And Hedrick family too, I don't mean any family one. Related that it was a drought year, and they would have prayer and they would see a cloud began to form out in Kansas, and when it got to Grandpa Frisbee's orchard line, it would start to rain. When it reached the other side, the rain had stopped, and there was no rain in Jackson County that year, speak of. And his crops got so heavy that he had to prop them up with tubifores, limbs, to keep them from breaking. He had a bumper crop, and he had the only crop in Jackson County which brought a premium price. And true to his covenant with the Lord, he gave that. And others made similar sacrifices of what they were able to, what crops and so forth that they grew. We have seen many efforts in the Church of Christ in my day of those who have tried to get possession of the temple lot. Just before my day, there was a big deluge of transfers from the reorganized church. Now, not all of them were guilty of this, but several of them confessed after they got over here and learned about the Church of Christ that they had been sent over by Fred M. Smith to come in and outnumber us and take the temple lot back to the organization. Bill Sheldon's grandfather, D.J. Sheldon, Randy's great-grandfather, was one. There were others. And they remained steadfast in the Church of Christ till their death. Brother Sheldon, T.J., was one of the apostles called in, I believe he was called in 27. Five were called in 26. Eventually the quorum was filled. We have seen men such as R.B. Trowbridge try to do the same thing. We've seen others through various means, try to find a way to get possession of the temple law. Why? Was it just for the money that they could get from it? No, Satan wants this place desecrated. He tries twice. The first little building that set just into the parking lot out here a little, and about halfway back to this building and forward, and it was only, I think it was 15 by 25 feet, all the larger it was. It was burnt by a disgruntled member. And most of us remember New Year's Day of 1990, what happened to the second building. And, you know, if the Lord don't have a purpose in this piece of ground, such as those whom he has directed in the past, for a righteous purpose unto him, and the fulfilling of the many of the revelations in the Bible and the Book of Mormon, particularly the Book of Mormon, concerning those things that will happen in the last days just before his coming. Then why didn't he just take us out of our misery and shove us off of this piece of ground and let it go for sale? You know, we could probably get $3-4 million off of that. That'd be enough to probably buy a new car for almost everybody in the church, at least in the United States. But no, that's not his purpose. This is a sacred spot of ground. This is like a piece of ground that has been dedicated by sacrifice before the Lord. This is a piece of ground that the Lord has a specific and absolute purpose for. Now, am I going to stand here and tell you that 2 years from now we're going to see the temple built? No, I'm not stupid. He's not told me, he's not told anyone else. The effort in 29 was premature, obviously, or to be standing there now. But it did give us witnesses to where the temple will be. Now, don't worship those stones down there. Remember them as any other person's testimony who testifies of the Lord Jesus Christ and the prophecies that he has given to the church. Study them, you young people especially, because you got more years ahead of you than most of the rest of us. And you're going to be faced with these questions. You're going to be faced with these pressures. And believe me, they're pressures. I remember only too well as a high school student up here at the old Chrisman building of the pressures that were on me to go across the way. Oh, it looked great over there. They never had any turmoils in the church that you could see. You know, my sister was caught up in that. She went over there. She found out that there's more problems over there than we have. But she don't want to come back. She said, I've already been there. She's looking for some new road. Well, I pray for her often. And for her family that she took, because she thought they'd be united over there, and not one of them go to church. So remember, when you hear that this piece of ground doesn't mean anything, it will not save your soul, no. But if you believe in Jesus Christ and God the Eternal Father and the Holy Ghost, and you rely upon those, it will be a place of refuge in the days to come. That's why a number of revelations have been given to come to independence. What did he say so often to all of the Jewish, I dare say in every Jewish synagogue in Palestine in his day? How oft would I gather you as a hen gathereth her chickens, you would not. Let us not be one of those that do not come under his wing and his care, his protection. You know, indeed, things of this life are not important. That is, food. Where did Noah or Moses get all the food to feed the millions of people that come up out of Egypt? Oh, he just dug in his hand behind pocket and got his wallet out and he went to the store. Oh, he didn't. Every morning the ground was covered with manna, but they only were allowed to take for one day, except on Saturday or Friday, whichever it was, and they took enough for 2 days. But on the third day, if they had any left, it spoiled and they couldn't eat it. Faith. And then they didn't like that, so he sent doves or quails. They get tired of that and they wanted something else. You know, we're never satisfied with what the Lord provides for us. You know, another thing that he told Moses, that his clothes would not wear out. None of them. They didn't. Read that in the scriptures. Study your scriptures. And if I'm feeding you bad information, come and tell me. Because I want to be right and true as much as any person ever walked here. I failed more than most of them. But that's still my desire. May God bless you each.
Thank you, Richard. Some announcements while you look for the closing hymn, which is 256. Fun, food, and fellowship. Come join us Friday for a barbecue, volleyball, and Christian fellowship at the first get-together of a new group for people in their college years, 20s and 30s. Let's get to know each other better as brothers and sisters in Christ. And the time has changed. We're going to put this back on the bulletin board now. It's marked here as 5:30 to 8:30, Friday, October 1st at George Owens Park. For information, contact D.A. Vogel, Aubrey Case, and Lisa Case. A note from our chorister. It's time to begin preparing the birthday celebration of our Savior. Christmas choir rehearsals will begin Sunday, October 10th at 4 o'clock. This year's cantata is a new one. They've never sung it before here. All interested singers are invited to come and begin the joyful process. Be sure and pick up a bulletin if you didn't this morning, because it has the officers for this year, for the Sunday school and the church, and also your schedule, which is an orange one this month. Last month was green. So take the green one down and put up the orange one. Monday night, study class at 7, Wednesday, prayer service at 7 as usual, Thursday, the setup of the garage sale at Caroline Hedrick's home, Friday and Saturday will be the United Workers garage sale from 8 to 5, both days. Saturday afternoon, the 50th wedding anniversary for Pat and Joe Hyatt here at church from 2 to 4, and the YPCL that night will have a study with Elder Don Case at Aubrey Case's home. Okay. October 8th and 9th, not very far away, the Women's Retreat. Details are on the flyer in the lobby. See Carrie Geyer or Jerry Adams. Hymn number 256, When You Found Your Place, Would You Stand, Please?